Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. Hello and welcome back. And we were talking about covetousness and I don't think we've finished that one. So I hope you can bear with us on this, about what is enough and why actually do we want more? Because you were talking about adornment and makeup and costumes and things like that, which can be wonderful. Mm. And then you want somebody else's or you want more of it. What is it? What is the lack in us that means we have to want more and more and more and more? Because actually we don't really want different. We want what the other's got. You know, we see something on an advert, oh, I want that. Yeah. Instead of creating our own. And when I think about it, you know, some of the happiest times of my life were the simplest times. Probably the best holiday ever. Well, no, there have been some wonderful holidays, was in a cottage in Radnorshire with my school friend Jo when we were 16. And her parents, we cycled to Radnor from Birmingham. And her dad drove behind us in the car, which was very sweet of him. And they left us on our own there for a week with our two bicycles. And so we cycled to buy what food we wanted. We cooked it on an open fire. We had no TV. We had no radio. We had no movie. We just cycled and walked. We did one wicked thing, was to go night riding once, which was to get on somebody else's horses, which I do not recommend. It's very bad. Don't do it. And we discovered standing stones and we talked and we made stories and it was just so lovely.
I don't know whether I'm very qualified to join in with this discussion on behalf of the rest of our culture, because it's all a bit lost on me, I'm afraid. I don't really watch TV, and I'm certainly, adverts wash over me when I do watch TV to the extent that typically I've actually got no idea what they're for, mm-hmm. especially if they're a complicated story. I'll be like, oh, you know, that was cute, or maybe not, but I often still am none the wiser as to what it is I'm supposed to go out and buy, because I just don't want most of it. But it seems to me, and I can only say this from a place of judgment and not from a place of experience, really, because it's not my way. But it seems to me that people who constantly want to buy stuff are trying to fill a hole that can only be lack. Mm-hmm. And that there must be presumably some kind of place where, I don't know, that new pair of shoes or whatever it is replacing the thing they really need, which is maybe it's self-esteem or maybe it's love or whatever. I don't know.
And no, I
know,
right.
I'm getting into kind of faux psychotherapy here.
But I think the root of that is correct. It has to be. We're trying to fill a space that things cannot fill.
Mm. Mm. And also, you know, if we are participating in the consensual reality of the West, then we are... If you do sit there and watch telly, that same telly or radio or whatever it is, or even, you know, Instagram, Facebook, all of them, unless you've got an ad blocker on, is constantly telling you that you need one of these, whatever it is, and that you'll be better in some way for having it.
Mm. And it's the same in experiences too. We've got to go further. We've got to... I'm going to be very, very rude. There's a thing called walking the Camino, mm-hmm. which is the walk to Santiago de Compostela, the Church of St. James. And it's a wonderful thing to do. But why do we have to post it all over Facebook? Do you know what I mean? It's this. And I've done it too. The thing of having to laud what we've got.
Mm.
To praise what we've got. Look what I've got. You can walk to Walsingham from here.
Well, you know, I was about to say exactly that. Is that what the thing I fundamentally don't get is that why would you walk to anywhere other than, in a way, here? I mean, I'm not... There's even a little bit of me that, I'm going to admit, goes slightly into judgment, even at the idea of things like holidays. I just find them weird, but I'm also so aware that I've got the insane privilege to live somewhere so exquisitely beautiful. You know, I live on Dartmoor. It's where people come on holiday. It's not, shouldn't be surprising that I find the idea of a holiday a little bit odd, because I live in paradise. You know, if I lived in the middle of London, as I once did, I'd be bloody clear on why you might need a holiday. So actually, I'll shut up about that one straight away. But that you should have to go to a different country to walk to the sacred is beyond bizarre to me.
And yet, yes, I hear that. And yet, I was very blessed, I didn't feel like it at the time, that my dad was a steam engine enthusiast and wrote books about steam engines and even had a TV show about steam engines. So after Blue Peter on Mondays, called Railway Roundabout. And he got into China just after it opened up because he wanted to see the steam engines. He was so passionate about them, and so is my brother, and we're a steam engine family. And he took my brother with him. And then my brother, so mean, got married, wanted to travel with his wife. And thank God my father looked around and went, oh, I've got another child. I wonder if my daughter would like to come. So from the beginning of the 1980s, I travelled with him every year to China. Mm. And that probably was a foundational point of my life, because I was in a country that had nothing. Mm. China's changed very much now. Mm. When we were there, you were lucky if you had an ensuite in a hotel. Very, very lucky. Usually the ladies' room was two floors down and it was a channel. Mm. And you all went in together. And of course, all the Chinese women would come and stare at me to see if I did it differently. And then they'd go away and say, she doesn't do it at all. I don't understand. Because until I got used to it, I didn't pee or dump in front of other women, because that wasn't the way I'd been trained. But of course, that was the way they do it, and that's the way an indigenous culture would do it. Mm. And I was basically the Princess Diana of a city, because I was sent out there to do some twinning work for Birmingham. So I was shown all round the city of Changchun in Manchuria. And they were really cross with me because I wasn't wearing smart enough clothes. And I wore sandals, which weren't what they wanted. So I learnt very quickly that they wanted you to dress up and wanted to present this sort of strange foreign appearance to them instead of being one of them. But one of the things that I did learn was how to live simply. Dad and I travelled on trains behind steam engines for up to 4 days at a time overnight in a compartment with two Chinese people. And we ate what they gave us, because that was all that there was. And I used to come back to the United Kingdom and I'd go into a supermarket and I would be outraged at 100 different kinds of shampoo. Mm. Because I'd lived for 6 weeks in a culture where there was nothing. Mm. There was absolutely nothing, and you could make do with the nothing. And the people, when we were travelling in these far-flung places, there were places I went to where I was the first white woman they'd ever seen. Mm. And they would make a banquet for us. You know, and try and see what a white woman was like drunk. And I had to learn very hard, very fast, to spit it out in my orange juice and spill it and then take another mouthful and go, yeah, and spit it out in my orange juice. And it was an extraordinary cultural experience for me, and it was very good for me. Mm. Because these people were quite certain that they were the most important nation on the planet. And that really hit me, because I'd always thought that we were the most important nation on the planet. So I actually think that travel can broaden the mind, but it's got to be travel that goes into the culture of the people. Travelling now in China wouldn't be the same, because China's infected by the West and wants everything the West has got, and now got pink-coloured poodles as accessories and that kind of thing. But when I was there, you were lucky if you stayed in the railway hotel. You were lucky if you got food that you could recognise. You ate what was there, and it was rude to eat the rice. Because if you ate the rice that was given to you at the end of the meal, it meant that you hadn't eaten enough. Wow. And we had to learn about the culture and listen to the people and live with the people and travel with the people. And they were always interested in me. Mm. And there was never that I noticed a moment of prejudice.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't got our attitudes. All the women, I learned very quickly, my suitcase was nicked at Beijing Airport once for 24 hours. And when it came back, it was quite obvious that all my clothes and jewellery had been tried on and then given back. And I thought that was enchanting. So I learned to wear pretty things, so that on the trains, the girls would come up and say, can I see that? And maybe this is the start of privilege or something, I don't know, because I'd end up taking little bits of jewellery that I could give them.
Yeah.
And one of the seminal points was when my dad always said, haggle with these people. Haggle, haggle when you want to buy something. But I tried it once. And this man said to me, why are you haggling with me? You are so rich.
Yeah.
And I went, I'm not rich. And he went, you are. You flew here. You yeah. are visiting here. You have everything. Why are you trying to get me down a few fen on something my wife has made?
Yeah.
And I, yeah, that just went right. I thought, I am an idiot. What an idiot I am. And there was another day, we went to a market in the far west on the borders of Tibet, where there was a stall which was run by a cooperative of the elderly people in that town who'd done paintings on paper. Mm. You know, those beautiful Chinese paintings. And they were exquisite. And we stood there in this shop. And my father said, how much are they? And they were about 2 pence each.
Whoa.
And my father said, would it be all right if we bought them all? And he didn't want to seem, you know, arrogant or privileged. But I would like to buy all of these. There were about 50 of them. And it was, I cry at this. The man in the shop went down on his knees before my father to thank him mm. for buying these pieces of paper. But for us, I still got, I'll show them to you next time you can come into the house, I'll show you the framed pictures that I've had for 35 years mm. that were just done by a little old lady somewhere that was so utterly magnificent. And I did come home humbled at the fact that they were so grateful that we just swept in and bought everything of theirs. And for me, that was humbling, but you can also see how for the egoic mind, you can just go in and say, I'll have all of that and I'll pay you nothing.
Mm.
So travel is both good and bad, I guess.
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I completely agree with you that to go and see other places in the world, to experience life, Gaia,
yeah. But not to go out
manifestations.
And find the Irish pub for bacon and egg.
What?
In Spain, which is what people do when they go to places. I'm sorry, it sounds so judgmental. I'm sorry, people go to Mallorca and places like that and eat English the whole time.
Right. Okay.
Oh, it's not in your experience, is it? No, no. When I went filming in China, because I actually made a TV documentary in the end, my last trip to China, which is when I met my first husband, the one who died, bless him. It turned out in the end that the China had Beijing by then had got a Holiday Inn, and the film crew were going, well, why didn't you book us into the Holiday Inn? Why didn't we go to the Holiday Inn? Why couldn't we have this decent Hong Kong type food? And I thought you wanted the experience of China.
Mm.
Well, that's why I haven't been back, because I had this experience of China, and I had a Chinese lover briefly. And it was the most extraordinary and beautiful experience, because we could not speak each other's language. So we couldn't mess it up with words.
Wow.
We could only touch and have expressions and tones of voice.
Wow.
And we had one night together, that man and I will remember that till the day I die. I don't know if he's alive. I don't know anything about him.
Wow.
But it was just glorious.
Yeah. Beautiful.
He'd have been arrested and thrown in jail if anybody found out about it.
Really? Why?
Consorting with a foreigner in those days. Oh, he was our goodness. Security guard. He was meant to keep us safe. He did actually save my life. I'm sorry, I'm going off on another thing.
Go on, let's hear it.
We were up in a place called Shan Hittan Forestry Railway, up in Jilin. It was very cold. And that's actually where Henry proposed to me a few years later. We were on a steam engine. It was a narrow gauge railway. It was a logging railway for getting trees down to the town. And there was a great big bridge, a very narrow, very simple bridge, which had space between the sleepers. So you could look down to the river, into a ravine. And while we were there, I asked how long the train was going to be there. And they said an hour. And I walked out onto the bridge and was standing over this ravine, and the train started.
Ooh!
And I couldn't get back to the edge of the bridge in time. There was nothing, I didn't know what to do. There was just the railing.
Whoa.
I just didn't know what to do. And this wonderful man, Meng, ran out in front of the train, ran across this bridge onto the sleepers, picked me up and went to the observation platform that he knew that was there halfway across and I didn't know was there, and held me to him as the train went past.
Wow.
And shouted at me, "You stupid, stupid, stupid English git," or equivalent in Chinese.
Yeah.
The word yingwezen was used, which is foreign devil. Stupid, stupid girl. And then as the train went past, because we'd had that war spirit and that huge adrenaline, just touched my hair and said in English, "Beautiful." Oh. And that was the start of it. So it was a really romantic thing.
Yeah.
Because he saved my life. But the whole...
My hero.
Yeah, your hero. But also, I'm telling lots of stories this time. I went back filming and Henry was the sound recordist on that. It was the first time I'd ever done a only time I've ever done a TV documentary. I was presenting and producing.
Mm.
And I had a film crew. I was so frightened. I was so out of my comfort zone that I dropped my shields.
Yeah.
Because I had no shields. There was nothing I was completely bare. And one evening, Henry went out to record Wild Track. It's where you get the sound of the countryside with nothing else happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you can put that underneath anything you need to dub on later.
Mm.
And so that was one of the things I liked about him. He would spend hours just sitting outside recording what was almost silence and listening, being quiet. But anyway, he proposed marriage to me after I took him a cup of hot chocolate because he'd been out doing Wild Track. And I knew, I always took sachets of hot chocolate with me. That was my little bit of covetousness in China. And you add in the hot water. Took him a mug. And he asked me in and sat me on the bed and asked me to marry him. I'd known him 9 days. He'd never even kissed me. What? And I was very polite. I said, I'd think about it, which I had no real intention to do. But the following morning, I couldn't sleep. We were doing some filming and I had to think about what I was going to say. And I was up with the dawn. It was very cold. And I went out in the morning for a walk on my own. And there was no birdsong because they'd eaten them because they had no food.
Yeah.
It wasn't a conceit. They ate them for food. And I got my Sony Walkman, you remember the old cassettes?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'd been given an album called Ark of a Diver by Steve Winwood, which I really hadn't listened to. And I was out there, sitting out there in the silence, and I was going to watch the sun come up. And I switched on the cassette. And I can't tell this story without crying either, but Steve Winwood's voice came out, this wonderful introduction on the song called While You See a Chance, Take It. And it's stand up in a clear blue morning. Can you see? Are you still free? Awake in a cold day dawning. And then it goes, while you see a chance, take it, find romance. While you see a chance, fake it, because it's all on you. And I stood there with this music from God in my ears, saying, here you are, Maggie, you have a chance to break your duck. There's an honourable man down there who wants to spend his life with you. Wake up and say yes. And I did. And I'm so glad I did, because he taught me about love. He taught me how to live with somebody. He taught me about simple things, and he died. Mm. And I was able to be there for him that last year. So that was just such an extraordinary blessing, which would never have happened if I hadn't been the other end of the world in simplicity.
Yeah. Yeah. And how tragic for us that we as a culture, I guess, one of our main stories is that in order to find simplicity, we do have to go to the other end of the world. We've completely forgotten that simplicity is actually a choice, and it's a choice that's available to us in any and every moment. And back to avarice, you can say no thank you to avarice and say yes please, oh how I love you, how enhancing you are to simplicity.
Mm.
And that... I actually believe that that's one of the amazing things that is going to have come out of the last 4 months or whatever it's been, is that I believe that as a culture, I haven't been on, what do you call it, furlough, and I don't know that many people who have been on furlough actually, but I believe that amongst those who have been on furlough, there is an enormous waking up to, I don't actually have to work that hard because I don't need that much money, And I don't want to spend my life at work when I could be spending it with my garden, my children, my partner, my dog, whatever.
Yeah.
And that, you know, what a disgusting privilege in one way to be able to sit at home for 4 months to figure out that you don't need to participate in false witness and all the other stuff,
yeah.
All the rest of it. But also, what an amazing blessing, you know. And we should all be, we should all, I eat those words instantly. There is an opportunity for us to be very grateful to all the ways in which the world is changing right now and has changed. Because maybe we are remembering, returning, remembering.
Remembering, putting back together.
Exactly. Remembering.
Yeah.
Putting back together a way of being in relationship with life that is far more in alignment with what and who we really are. And I read somewhere the statement, how you spend your day is how you spend your life.
Yes.
And I really see that to be the case, and that, again, the lucky few, basically, as ever, have had the opportunity to reevaluate how they spend their days.
Yes.
And realise that that is how they spend their lives, and to potentially want to make a change, which, as with all things, as with our teeny-weeny discussions, as with our intentions, as with our openness to be the change, you know, it only takes a few to make a wave. We are walking permission for one another, all of us. And it, you know, just even just one person wanting a bit less, realizing that they don't need a new one, a better one, a faster one, the upgrade, whatever. Every time one person does that, the world changes.
And that's what the ego can't understand, because it says it's got to be a big movement.
Yes.
But it is the butterfly wing.
Yeah.
That causes a wind, that causes a hurricane the other side of the world. And it's the 100th monkey.
Mm. Which is apocryphal, but nonetheless true.
Yes, exactly. But that's what myth is. The word myth is a perennial truth told in a story.
Yeah.
So all myths at heart are true.
Yes.
Lord of the Rings is true. The Narnia stories are true. They didn't happen, but they're true. And that's why when people come up to me and say, did Jesus die on the cross? Was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene? Did Jesus even exist? My answer is, I don't give a rap. Because the story's true.
Bet it isn't. Bet you say rat's ass.
Yeah, I didn't want to be rude to the rat we've got in the compost heap. Yes. Yes, absolutely. And again, coming back to Christianity, because it's my job, what Jesus said was, what you do to the least of these, you do to me. And he was talking as Christ, as the creation, as the divine. What you do to the very least, you do to God.
Of course, because God is the very least.
Yes. Not a sparrow falls. And
what's the rest of that? I know there's more
without God observing it. God,
right.
God watches it. Not a sparrow falls. And consider the lilies of the field. They do not weave, neither do they sow. But I tell you, Solomon in all his glory was not attired like one of those.
Mm.
You know, and it's riddled. The Gospels are riddled with the simple life in peace and in justice and in lack of judgment. The only people Jesus shouts at is the lawmakers who put law before love. And whoa, wouldn't he be shouting at the patriarchal Christian faith now? And probably, well, no, he wouldn't. He'd just be showing them a better example.
Mm.
And that's all we can do. That's what we do by that one act of recycling or that one act of doing something which seems utterly simple. I burn quite a lot. If I have to buy plastic, I burn it here. And I apologise to the Great Mother every time I do it. And I say, I am so sorry. But this, if I don't burn it in the beautiful air of Dartmoor here and ask your forgiveness, it will go to Malaysia where little girls have bleeding noses from the fires of burning plastic. It is an evil that I must do here because I know you're big enough to take it and please forgive me.
Wow.
But there are piles of our refuse in places like Malaysia and the Maldives that are being burnt. and the children. There was a Hugh Fearnley Whittestall, I call him Huge Furry Willie Stall, documentary. Sorry about that. Taking it down to the lowest common denominator, where he went out and talked to families where the children had persistent nosebleeds and blood coming from their eyes because of the toxic fumes in the air from the Western plastics that are being burnt there.
God.
And they were stuff that was meant to be recycled. He was having Sainsbury's bags and everything.
It's so utterly.
So I can't change that evil right now, Mother. I can do my absolute best not to buy anything with plastic, though the last few months that's been quite difficult. But I can say, I'm so sorry. Please, will you heal this air on Dartmoor?
I'm so ferociously
anti-plastic.
Anti-plastic and hardline that I'm afraid I just don't. No. Buy it. I refuse point blank to buy it. Mm. I haven't eaten yogurt in months and months and months and months and months. Mm. I adore yogurt. Mm. But there is only one shop that I know of that sells yogurt in a glass jar.
Mm.
And although actually I did make some. I made some of my own. That was exciting.
Yes.
And pretty successful, actually. And I don't know why I don't make more, because I do absolutely adore yogurt. But yeah, it's certainly up here where, my goodness, we are so privileged to have so many artisan makers, you know, bakers and foragers. And
I've got about 20 plastic pots for some wonderful face cream I used to buy from the shop down in the village below us. And it's almond oil and honey from their own bees, but it's in plastic.
Mm.
And I've got all these pots. I'm actually going to post them back to them and say, please, can you just at least use them again? But I've now found a supplier, Kenwardine Aromatherapy. Find it online in glass pots. Beautiful. Handmade lotions for your face at the same price. There's less in there, but it's got to be. And we realise we live with fairly tightened belts, my husband and I, because it's really important that we do what we can, even if it's not that much. You know, I always, whenever I can, and it's been lately difficult this year, take my own pots to the butcher and take my own pots to the organic shop in Okehampton.
Mm.
And it turns out apparently cardboard's really difficult to recycle sometimes too. Oh,
no, not if you've got a garden. Cardboard's amazing.
Yes,
mulch.
Yes. Well, you were talking about that for the vegetable garden. No, it wasn't you. It was another lady.
Excuse me.
But yes. Put down cardboard, and then you can plant your plants through it.
Absolutely.
And it turns into mulch. And I've now got, I used to buy those little pots you can get from a garden centre that composted, where you put your seedlings in them. Blue roll.
Yeah, blue roll.
Blue roll. And when you have to do it, it's, well, I find it enjoyable, but then I've got 12 bottles of elderflower champagne sitting in the kitchen, which cost me the price of some lemons and some sugar and some recycled bottles. We've got quite some time now, and it's delicious. So I'm so glad that we live here, and I understand it's really difficult for people in cities, but there must be a tiny thing that you can do, even if it's only growing a tomato on your windowsill.
Well, and even in a city, you know, as far as I understand it, it is possible to make choices. You know, there's always a choice that's better than another choice kind of thing when it comes to plastic packaging or the origin of something, or, you know, do you really need to eat avocados? They definitely don't grow here. Do you really need a apple in August when there are only apples from Chile because ours aren't ready yet and we've eaten all of last year's? You know, there's seasonal eating, local purchasing, and just, you know, back to less. We need so much less, including typically food. You know, there's an epidemic of obesity in the West. We clearly eat too much, and
we eat addictive substances. Dairy can be addictive.
Yeah.
And monosodium glutamate and all the things we get in the takeaways. And people are so, the ancient Rome, when it was failing, lived on takeaways.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't have kitchens in the houses. I did all this research when I wrote the Book of Deborah. And they all lived in apartments in the cities, places like Alexandria and Rome, and they went out and bought street food.
Wow, fascinating.
They very rarely cooked. If you had a big mansion, if you were very wealthy, you could have staff and they would cook for you. But the average person ate takeaways.
Wow.
So and well, we are in the decline and fall of the Roman Empire right now. This is being redone. This is what's happening, I think.
Yeah.
Bring on the barbarian hordes! Who were not barbarians?
I hope I am the barbarian hordes.
Yes, the barbarians were not anti-cultured at all. So here we are lecturing about don't use plastic and don't wear too many clothes and basically be happy.
That's not what I said.
I know. I know, but somebody might take offence at it. And we are blessed that we can live relatively simple lives. But I just say again and again, whatever you can do matters.
Mm.
Because you are the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And also what you believe about yourself is what you're going to believe about others.
Yep, totally.
All the hatred and anger in the world comes from unhappy people. If you've ever read Elizabeth Gilbert's book, Eat, Pray, Love, she got a load of flack for writing it because she got a large advance. So she was brokenhearted after she'd ended her marriage and she couldn't understand why she didn't want to be married. She didn't understand why she didn't want this life. Mm. And she spent a year travelling the world. The first 3 months were in Italy eating herself stupid.
Mm.
And getting through depression. And the second 3 months were India at an ashram. And the third 3 months were in Bali. And, of course, she could afford to go those places to find herself. But she's come up with some wonderful quotations, which I'm going to paraphrase, which is the search for happiness is not a selfish act.
No.
Because in her unhappiness, she dragged down other people with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was mean and she was avaricious. And so the search of happiness for yourself is a generous gift to the world.
But also, it seems to me, and obviously I can only speak from my own experience and that which I've observed, is that the search for happiness can't be anything other than a selfless act. I mean,
it's self-full.
Self-full, yeah. Because happiness is not found in the gold aisle at Harrods or Macy's or whatever, and it's not found in purchasing, and it's not found in status, and it's not found in any of those things that aren't good for the world. It seems to me that happiness is found in connection, and that it is as simple as that. And whether we find our connection with humans, with the other than human kin, whether it be your dog, your cat, the oak, the ash, the maple tree, whoever, that's where we find connection. We find happiness. We find happiness in connection and in community. And I don't just mean human community.
Yeah.
And that then when we're happy, happiness is also, it seems to me, a state of feeling fulfilled, when people feel fulfilled.
Yes.
And fulfillment is predicated upon having some decent self-esteem and, once again, on connection.
Yeah.
Self-esteem itself is predicated upon connection. You feel good about yourself when you know that you're not doing anything that you judge against yourself, but also when you know that other people value you. We are kind of... Yeah. We see one another, I guess, more clearly in each other's eyes than we do in the mirror. You know, other people are the mirror for us, really, a lot.
And we don't realise that the road to joy is the road itself.
Mm.
You can't get to joy in a road of misery.
Nope.
And there were three things that were pivotal in my healing from cancer. And the first was simplicity. I got to the stage where all I could do is sit in the living room and watch the birds on the bird feeder.
Mm.
I couldn't even walk out to fill the bird feeder. But I sat day after day and it was enough.
Mm.
It was enough. The beauty of the goldfinches and the bullfinches and the chaffinches, and we had yellowhammers as well. And just sitting there in wonder at this tiny, simple thing.
Mm.
And the other thing was pilgrimage. I was ill enough that I really couldn't walk very far. My lungs were full of fluid. And I'd booked a conference in Albuquerque with Father Richard Rohr, the Franciscan friar that I study with.
Mm.
And I wasn't well enough to go. But I thought, this is my pilgrimage. This might be the last thing I do on earth. What do I want to do with it? I want to go and sit with him.
Mm.
And I sold nearly all my jewellery, thank you eBay, to pay for the fare. And I could only take hand luggage for 3 weeks because I couldn't carry. Mm. I had to have a wheelchair at the airports. So I had to go have the humility of accepting that. Mm. I had to have Uber to get me to the conference centre. And the guy who picked me up from the airport in Albuquerque, bless him, said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I'm at a conference on the Trinity." And he went, "Oh, you're a Christian." And again, that was tribal, but he was a Christian too. He was a Southern Baptist, God help him. But sorry. But he, as soon as he knew I was there for that purpose, his attitude towards me changed, which was interesting. And he took me to a supermarket to buy me food to feed myself that night because he knew I couldn't walk.
Mm.
You know, and he went round and picked up things. Would you like this? Would you like that? And that was, it wasn't Christian, that was human.
Mm.
And I was there and I found friends who helped me, took me out to eat. And I actually went on another pilgrimage to Santa Fe after the conference because my bishop said, "If you find a statue of St. Francis there, would you ask Richard Rohr to bless it for me?" And there were none that I could find in Albuquerque, but I could take a train to Santa Fe and I could just about totter around Santa Fe. And the last place I went, I found a little statue of St. Francis for my bishop and brought it back and asked Bridget and all that. But it was after that that I started to heal. And it was all so simple. I had no money while I was out there. I had absolutely the basics. I couldn't eat out. I just bought stuff from a cheap supermarket. Okay, it was Uber, but it was $4 an Uber. And it was just, I think probably valuing myself enough to take a pilgrimage to somebody I knew was love.
Yeah. Well, and also to look at yourself and go, if this is the last thing I do with my life,
it must be done.
Yeah.
Then... And to have a husband who agreed with that.
Mm.
You go. And I will pick you up from the airport and I will be on the phone if you need me every night. But you go. And if you die there, you die there.
Yeah.
God knows what happened with the American health system, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't. You know, I actually thought there might be a miracle while I was there, but the miracle came later. Mm. That's okay, because miracles don't have to work in my time.
Can't order them on Uber.
Apparently not. No. Well, I did, didn't I? Anyway, we're on 36 minutes. Anything final for you to say? Because I've just monopolised that again.
Nope. No, I fear that we might be straying into being a bit preachy. And if so, apologies. And
at least if we're preachy, we usually have a story to back it up. And hopefully we'll get it right. And I don't think either of us said fuck this time either. So.
Got to get one in quickly before the end.
thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.